This is Icon Art Radio, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. And I'm Bill Teeple. I'm here with Donna Colby and Alan Cobb. I know for the last session, I came late, and you were talking about very interesting stuff about digital images and all the stuff that goes in one ear and out the other for me, one eye and out the other eye. And then you got talking about color and the eye, the way that eye perceives. And I thought I'd like to pursue this a little bit further because you're such a wealth of information, Alan, in this area. Anytime I need to know something technical, I get Alan on the phone and then I get a treatise and I love it.
Yes, but let that be a warning to the world. you don't want a treatise.
So you were asking at the end of the last show, I think, Donna, about the after image. And I was wondering about pigments, primaries, and the light primaries, and how all that works. Why don't you ask your question?
And okay, then... we can lead in. One leads into the other, sort of. So my question was, when you're looking at something green, say a big field of grass, and you close your eyes, you see red. It's complement, and other complementary colors work that way too. So what's actually happening? Why, when you close your eyes, do you see the opposite of the color there?
Well, remember, although the eye is kind of a digital image sensor, like the one in a digital camera, I mean, surprisingly digital in a sense, it works by dint of change. Something has to change or you don't see anything. And that's because of a phenomenon known as habituation. The individual red sensor or green sensor gets habituated to that level of input signal, and it stops sending, it's not being triggered anymore. It's just the light hasn't changed, so it doesn't send a signal containing information about the change. When you suddenly close your eyes, now everything has changed, but that sensor has been accustomed to a very high signal on that particular color. And so suddenly it's transmitting a very low signal on that color, whereas the adjacent sensors are transmitting very low signals on other colors. And it takes a period of time for the cone actually to adapt to the blackness, to the lack of light. So while it's adapting, it's still sending a signal, but it's sending a signal of the absence of green instead of the presence of green, which the brain interprets as the opposite of green. So you really are sending a negative. If you were to take a picture of that field with your digital camera and bring it into the computer and tell the computer to reverse all the colors, it would look like what you see, more or less, when you stare at it very hard for a long time and then suddenly close your eyes. Or more interestingly, perhaps, if you were to get a film camera and with color film take a picture of that, then just look at the negative.
Oh, yeah.
Color negatives are backwards.
Huh.
They're just like the after image you get when you suddenly close your eyes.
Now, is that just a thing we have to live with, or is there a real reason for it? Is there some
plus? It's a mechanical reason.
And in art, you put red and green next to each other, and they amplify each other.
Right. So these are not red and green next to each other. These are red and green replacing each other.
No, I understand that, but what I'm saying is because of the after image in the eye.
Oh yes.
When you're looking at red and green, and because of the fluctuation.
That's right, because your eye is doing
the eye fluctuates across the border. So if you try to stare at the border, the eye is still fluctuating. So what happens is you get a neon green line on one side and a neon red line on the other.
Or even multiple lines almost.
So in a way, I mean, it almost seems like there's some delightful effects because of this thing happening in the way we perceive things.
Yeah, and it's accentuated by the saccades that we talked about last week, where the fact that the eye is doing tiny little motions so that the image is constantly changing and the nerves keep being re-stimulated even if the picture isn't changing, even if the world around us is still. And so that means that in one moment, the green line, the edge between the green and the red is a little bit to the right. And in the next moment, that same edge is a little bit to the left. And there's a whole row of cones in your eye that suddenly have to switch from seeing just green to seeing just red. And they see the opposite for a while, just as if you closed your eyes while they adapt to the opposite color. Actually, what's happening is that, you know, the green cones are suddenly not being triggered and the red cones suddenly are being triggered. And then 100 milliseconds later or whatever, there's another saccade, and suddenly now the red cones are not being stimulated and the green cones are being stimulated in that one vertical edge. And the reality of it is that we can't actually see an edge. There's no such thing as an edge inside your eye. It's a sort of hexagonal arrangement of cones, not unlike, you know, the face of a sunflower or something, where you have all these little things that are more or less round and they're all packed closely together, and the closest packing density for round things is, you know, hexagons with one in the middle, kind of, and you can line them all up and they pack without wasting any space. And that's the way the center of our eye is set up. But what's even more bizarre is that the whole concept of an edge is something that we can only dimly see with our eyes, even though we know it in the mind's eye without any ambiguity at all. Edges are like critically obvious. But if you were to take a camera and wave it around the room in a manner analogous to the way your eyes are flitting around the room as we sit here talking to each other, and then look at what's happening inside the camera, those images are crazed. They're jumping all over the place. The perspective of the room is changing from every one of those glances to the next. And the brain is putting it all together and saying, ah, the room is absolutely still. It's just sitting out there where it belongs. And there are vertical edges all over things and horizontal edges all over things. And they just go in perfectly straight lines. Even though they're bent in any one of those images, they all have optical distortion in them. And as we move our heads and move our eyes, that distortion switches around and the room's perspective changes and things get foreshortened in different ways. And we just miss all that because the brain isn't showing us what our eyes are capturing. It's not showing us the image on the retina. It's building a model of the room in 3D and telling us that is what you are seeing. It's not showing us what we're seeing. It's telling us what we're seeing. And that's
there's a book called, have you read it? It's the kind of thing you might read. Proust is a neuroscientist.
No, I haven't seen it.
And he talks in there about different artists and stuff and how the artists were understanding all this stuff that the neuroscientists can describe, and particularly in memory with Proust.
Yeah.
But there's one on Cézanne, and he's talking about Cézanne is talking about this thing you're talking about with his paintings. Mm-hmm. What the eye is actually, what you're actually taking in, as opposed to the processing by the brain.
Right. I've always thought that Rembrandt had some kind of uncanny ability to separate his processed vision from his physical vision, so that he could see that this image before me is, you know, it's lit by a candle and it doesn't have a full spectrum of colors in it by a long shot. It's an incredibly narrow piece of the spectrum, and yet he can mix colors on his palette and paint them onto the canvas in such a way that when you look at it, you know that there's a full range of color there, even though there isn't. And if you go and analyze the pigment, you don't find all the colors. They're, you know, largely missing. And I think that's part of the thing. I mean, even just learning to draw, you know, the difference between, oh, it's an apple and it's an edge shaped like that and it has this kind of light on it and the light's more here than it is there. you're in a sense, you're learning not to see,
right,
in order to draw and paint.
Right, exactly.
It's sort of, you know, the opposite of what you would expect.
I feel like a little kid in a Mr. Wizard show. Or something. It's like one of these little kids that wants to like pop their hand up all the time and ask like a million questions because this guy knows all this weird stuff that happens all the time and we don't.
Yeah, well, there's another radio show in all of this, I think.
Yeah, it's very cool. So, or before we started recording the show, you were talking about something very fascinating about how on the computer you have, on the computer you have red, green, blue.
Bill was bringing that up, the difference between reflected light and transmitted light.
And your eyes have red, green, green.
You
were talking about the two greens and the receptors in the eye.
Yeah, the eye uses a three-color system, just like our inkjet printers. Well, just not like our inkjet printers, just like our LCD panel.
Screen, yeah.
But between the sensor and your eye, which is red, green, blue, and the brain, there are actually four neural pathways. There's a wonderful book on all of this stuff that goes into it in tremendous detail called Why We See the Way We See. And he goes into this fact that there are four neural pathways which correspond to red, green, green, and blue, instead of red, green, and blue. And the effect of there being two green channels interferes with the understanding of the colors, of the primary colors. You know, as an artist, we see the color wheel represented in a million different contexts. A digital photography program will have the same color wheel in it, and a graphics program will have the same color wheel in it. When you're teaching basic color in an art class, you'll see the same color wheel. And the colors blend smoothly from one to another, and we know that they are on a continuous spectrum. But there's a problem between red and green. You can't blend smoothly from red to green without going through blech. And it's some kind of horrible sort of, if you're using bright colors, a sort of horrible, sickly, greenish, muddy, brownish, disgusting color that's really not even attractive. It's not tan, it's not gray, it's not yellow.
It's not bittersweet chocolate.
It's not bittersweet chocolate. It's just some kind of really weird, undefinable shades that the mind kind of recoils from. And those are probably, it would be fair to say that those aren't colors. They don't exist in nature, and they're not happening, you know, in the eye. What's happening is these four channels are reproducing something that's occurring in three channels, and one channel's getting exaggerated and distorted. The payoff is that we have excess discrimination in the yellow range, in the green range. And maybe that's because, you know, we grew up in forests and jungles and things, and nature is full of chlorophyll. And if we evolved in an environment that's teeming with red, with green chlorophyll, then, you know, it's very helpful to be able to see the shades of green with more discrimination than we can any other color.
Now, that what's very interesting about that is that when they first started making pigments for artists to paint with, the one color that they had a tremendous deal of difficulty reproducing was green. It was the hardest one, and it's probably because of exactly this, that when an artist was looking out over a landscape trying to paint all those greens that he was seeing with the pigments that they were able to make to produce green, they couldn't produce enough variation of greens to
reproduce
what he was seeing.
And mixing the greens is more challenging because if you're mixing anything, if you want to warm up the green a little bit, you can't just put in a little red or any of the pigments that lean towards red mm-hmm. without risking obliterating the greenness. Mm-hmm. And it obliterates sometimes with just the tiniest change in that direction. Whereas, you know, if you're trying to go from green to blue, you've got all kinds of latitude. There's a million shades between green and blue, and they all are between green and blue. Mm. But there aren't a million shades between green and red. I mean, there are, but many of them are just not what you meant.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm getting fairly confused over here. I've got to have some clarity in when we're talking about... because I know how to mix colors with a paintbrush, and I know that color wheel, but I don't know that much about light. And you said reflective colors a minute ago?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you mix, it's a different set of primary colors
right.
in light, and you mix them together and you get white light.
Right.
And then with pigments, you got red, yellow, and blue as your pigments.
Right.
And you mix, as your primaries, you mix them together and you get black.
Right.
So I understand how we can get the muddy colors in that context, but when you're talking about red and green being next to each other, are they next to each other in the light spectrum, or how does this all work?
Yeah, I mean the color wheel that you see for you know digital photography. I mean, it looks like the same color wheel. It's just that the continuity between the red and the green is messed up by the way the eye. The way the brain interprets what's coming in from the eye. I'm sure that they blend quite perfectly within the eye, because if you think about it mechanically, you've got three light sensors. And if you shine a green light on the green cones and a blue light on the blue cones and a red light on the red cones, there's no reason at all why you can't turn down the blue all the way so you just have red and green on, and then you can turn the brightness of the red one down continuously till it's off and you have pure green, or you can turn it back up all the way and then turn the green down and you have pure red, and there's no reason why that wouldn't produce a nice, pleasant, continuous blend from red to green. And when you do that, it doesn't produce a nice, smooth blend. And it's because we don't see green the same way we see the other two colors. It's being processed twice and in ways that are not all color related. That second green channel, they think, is primarily for luminance information, for the brightness rather than the chrominance information. So why subjectively it comes out to be, you know, this sort of weird, you know, dead fish kind of color, I don't know. But the other part of your question is this thing, the difference between transmissive color and reflective color.
Right.
And that's really interesting, because when you look at something, when you have like a red light source, what's happening is red light is coming out of that thing. And if it hits a surface that isn't absorbing any color in particular, if it hits a white surface, which doesn't absorb any color as much at all, then it bounces off and you get red into your eye. If you shine that, if you take it the other way around, you take a white light and you bounce it off a red surface, we call it a red surface because it doesn't absorb red. It absorbs green and blue. So that's what pigments do, is they absorb the colors that we don't see.
Right.
And so when you mix a pigment that absorbs everything but red, and a pigment that absorbs, or let's say magenta, and a pigment that absorbs everything but cyan, and a pigment that absorbs everything but yellow, the three primary colors for pigments, the cyan, yellow, and magenta are now absorbed everything. Each one of them absorbed everything but its, and the others absorbed that one. So you've got two pigments absorbing yellow and two pigments absorbing magenta and two pigments absorbing cyan, and that leaves you with black.
Right.
Whereas if you take a light that's emitting red and a light that's emitting green and a light that's emitting blue, they mix together without anything being lost, and you now have white light, which when it hits, you know, red pigment, comes back red because the other shades, the other frequencies were absorbed. So I'm not sure if that is, you know,
yeah,
sort of
it does actually
viscerally
give me
satisfying.
No, it does. That explains it fairly well.
It's the essence of it.
It's hard to even ask questions because this, when you're giving these explanations, there are like so many things that I want to know more about, but can't think of an actual question to probe into it, because it's just fascinating to me that there's so much going on. I mean, it's like that with any part of our body. We're talking about the eyes right now. We can talk about any part of our body, and it's absolutely astonishing all that's going on at every millisecond.
I think it's amazing that it even works at all.
Yeah,
it
really
blows my mind.
And that we get
this bag of sticks and giblets, and it somehow I can move. I'm in it.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm driving this thing, but I'm not.
And we get puzzled when something goes wrong, but we should actually be much more puzzled
that it doesn't go wrong.
That it doesn't, you know, and that we can live 100 years.
Yeah.
With.
Yeah.
These parts, you know, these incredibly precise machines, you know, or whatever you want to call it, that are doing all these things every.
Well, the thing that gets to me more than anything else in this context is how much the experience of the senses is different from the stimulus of the senses that gives rise to the experience. The ears are, you know, in this ocean of vibration, and yet what we're hearing is people talking in a room, along with there's a bazillion other noises and things going on. Just the echoes of the people talking in the room are enough to make it imperceptible, but it works great. And I see the room visually as a rectangular solid, you know, in space with things positioned in consistent positions, and everything is fitting into all these geometric principles that I instinctively understand. And yet that's not what's happening on my retina. The image is upside down on my retina, for starters, you know, because it's going through a simplex lens. It's not being turned right side up again. And if you have people walk around with glasses on that flip the image upside down, within, I think, as little as a half an hour, they begin to adapt to it. And it's, it's okay. I'm not going to fall down anymore. And after, you know, after a day, they almost, you know, have fully adapted. And then you take them off and they're just as disoriented as they were when they put them on. Mm. So the thing happening in the brain, you know, the movie screen on which we experience all of our senses, it's like I was saying before, it's something that's being, you know, prepared for us and laid on us by the central nervous system. It's not simply a representation of what the senses themselves on the outside are picking up. We're not seeing what's happening inside the eye, and we're not hearing what's happening inside the ears. And of course, when you get into some of the other senses, it's even more bizarre to think that we could be smelling what's happening inside the nose. What does that even mean? What could a smell even mean? It's like, it's a chemistry lab. Mm-hmm. Smell is a chemical detector, and it's a differentiator among, you know, a bazillion different kinds of chemical compositions, some of which are dangerous, and they conveniently smell bad. Mm-hmm. And some of them are you know, life supporting, and especially at mealtime, they happen to smell really good. But that smell doesn't even, you can't even describe the smell other than to say it's in terms of whether you like it or not and what other things it reminds you of. But you are in fact responding emotionally and you know, sensorially to subtle differences in chemical makeup.
Well, and what's fascinating is that you can have a memory of a smell.
Oh, yeah.
Or a memory of a taste.
Mm-hmm.
And there it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's
All right, well, and the smell is, the smell takes place more or less in the rhinoencephalon, which is one of the oldest parts of the brain in terms of evolution. And I believe that the rhinoencephalon is also the portion of the brain associated with long-term memory and emotion.
Oh, fascinating.
Very long-term.
Huh.
And so that would explain why when you get a whiff of something every now and then, it takes you back to like an entire experience without anything visual or auditory or tactile, just sort of the whole sense of being someplace. Mm-hmm. There's a certain smell that I get when I'm in the spring that reminds me of New York City in the spring, the smell of the sidewalk and the pavement and the exhaust and things, and it sounds like a horrible thing to smell, but it's actually this sort of unusual, atypical sweetness in the air in New York.
I just
and
smelled
it blows it. Me away when I
when
experience
that. When you describe that, I just smell. I don't know if I smelled spring in New York, but I smelled New York.
Yeah.
Just as you were describing those elements, it wasn't just that I had to conjure it up.
Yeah,
it's that memory of.
Yeah,
a day when there's wet pavement in New York, it was just like there.
Yeah.
Immediately. Interesting.
So we live in a world of illusions. All of our sensory experiences are completely inaccurate, but highly useful. Mm-hmm. And we can infer accurately from them, but the individual experience of the day going by, you know, and the back of your eyeball or the you know membrane on your cochlea or the little hairs sticking up inside your sinuses or whatever. It's just a tremendous fabrication.
So we can thank our inner editor for putting it all together and making a masterpiece out of something that could be chaos if we didn't have that editing system going on.
It would be very chaotic.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to demonstrating this on an odd Thursday. Just an image of a rectangle with ripples like expanding from the center as if you dropped a stone in a pond. And after those ripples have bounced off the sides of the rectangle a little bit, the whole rectangle is just full of grayness, just chaos. And yet if that ripple were a sine wave and your ear were in that field of chaos, you'd hear a pure tone.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.